From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Francis de Vericourt. He's professor of management science and the director of the Center for Decisions, Models, and Data at the European School of Management and Technology in Berlin. He has written, with two other gentlemen, Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. Framing is the essential tool that will enable humanity to find the best way through a forest of looming problems. Consider the disasters of framing COVID-19 as equivalent to seasonal flu, and how framing is akin to SARS delivered New Zealand from the pandemic. Francis de Vericourt, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. Ever since I read the book, I can't have a conversation without thinking if I'm framing something, and it's just really interesting. Maybe you can start by defining what a mental model is, what framing is.
Well, you said it. Framing is a mental model. It's a representation of the world that highlights some aspect of the world, but also obfuscate others in a way that helps you decide. So it's really a model of reality that simplifies things for you, but in a way that helps you being efficient and innovative.
And we use mental models all the time, even if we're not aware of it. And as you say in the book, it's the particular lens through we look at the situation, our sense of the world individually, but also it could be countrywide. The example you have in the book, one of the examples, is that the way that COVID was framed by the UK was it was a seasonal flu, and that was disastrous. And the way New Zealand framed it and made their approach and their entire strategy towards it was to look at it as a SARS equivalent, which completely knocked the virus down, didn't it?
That's exactly right. I mean, what is interesting is that there's actually a precedent. I mean, we were writing the book when the pandemic arrived. And in fact, we were writing about Ebola. I do not know if you remember, it was about 5 years ago, it happened in Africa. And here again, you had two organizations on the ground that were framing the problem differently. And one was right, the other was wrong. And it ended up in a disaster for Africa. And as we were writing about that, SARS occurred. And as it happened, the UK, as you said, it framed the situation as a flu. That is something a bit more dangerous, but something that could be contained. And they approach it as containment. While New Zealand is an interesting country because it's linked to the UK. And so it had the frames and the mental representation of the UK, but it's also in Asia. And in Asia, there was 10 years, 20 years ago now, SARS. And so they were stuck into these two different representations. And they started with a bit of the flu, didn't work well very fast. They changed the reframing of the situation. They reframed the situation and look at it as SARS and start to eliminate and take totally different actions.
I'm wondering, As John said, that framing has been around for a while. Many of us do it, but we also, for so long, have been focused on traits like memory and reasoning that you say, because those are more apparent in human cognition, framing is not something that we've employed maybe in our conscious minds.
I mean, some people did naturally. I think it's more the research didn't look at it too much. They were looking at the basics of cognitions and making great progress. It's only in the very recently in human history, I mean, started after World War II, I guess, that people started to realize we were thinking in mental model. And it's late 80s, 90s that it started to pick up. And in the 2000s, really, where there had been a lot of research about how we represent the world, how we frame situations, and how that works or does not work.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you talk about the power of reframing a societal problem, and you talk about the Me Too movement that existed, but no one really knew it existed until it was framed in the hashtag MeToo sort of way. Can you tell us about what happened there and how the whole world now recognizes it?
Well, the Me Too movement is really a very powerful reframing that instead of framing victims as victims, it really empower them. So it really shift the burden on the bad people, if you want. And so that reframing that happened on Twitter, in fact, that there was one email sent that overnight received was retweeted many times, has been embraced precisely because it empowered the victim in a very, very strong way. So it was in the air, but not as prevalent before the Me Too movement or the hashtag Me Too movement. And we use it in the book because we want to show that if you frame social problem the right way, it can be an extremely powerful device to change things.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Francis De Vericourt. He's professor of management and science and director of the Center for Decisions, Models, and Data at the European School of Management and Technology in Berlin. He's written Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. There is so much in this book, Francis, and at the same time, there's two big takeaways that I have. One is that we have some big problems in our world, and maybe if we can learn to reframe the way we have tried to tackle these problems in the past, maybe we can all learn from it. But the other takeaway I have is that for me as an individual and other individuals out there, if you have a strategy in your life that's not working, then maybe you want to think about reframing the problem. And one of the things, you know, Lynn and I are computer geeks, but the story of Alan Kay, who was frustrated by procedural programming in the 1970s, he worked at Xerox PARC, and he decided that they needed to look at it a completely different way, and he came up with object-oriented programming. Can you talk about that reframing?
I mean, let me address first the first point that where I strongly agree that we are facing challenging times and we need to reframe. I want to really make the point that we know we are facing challenging times thanks to our frames. And one example is global warming. Sorry to bring that up, but we know there is such a thing as global warming because we have the right frame to perceive a reality that is coming, that does not exist yet, but it's coming. And same for the pandemic. So we started to see that it could be a real danger before it really happened because we had the right mental models to extrapolate. Now, to go back to the story of computing, one thing that people tend to forget is that the computer, since you're a computer geek, and I am too, I must confess, but since you're a computer geek, the computer, the machine that we are using, that we take for granted, that has been disrupted our society since the end of the 20th century, was born as an act of reframing. If you know the story, this is Alan Turing, who was working on a mathematical problem, which had nothing to do with computers at the time. And he was reframing what a computer, a mathematical proof was. So these reframings, his change of representation about what a mathematical proof was, he thought of it as tapping on a typewriter. And that typewriter became the computer. So computer science is really the outcome of a fundamental change of representation of something, you know, complicated, which is mathematical proofs. But it tells you that even computer science in general, that we take for granted the technology, is born out of an act of reframing. And same for the change of procedural computing to object, which is a totally different way of looking at programming, where you think in terms of a centralized way of programming, and you reframe it as decentralizing your programs.
And then Steve Jobs takes a ride 10 minutes away from where he lives to Xerox PARC in Silicon Valley, And he takes a tour of all this, and then he reframes the whole thing in a personal computing experience procedural and what has become the mouse and a number of other things that he lifted from, not lifted, but, you know, he observed and he decided to reframe. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yes, that's very correct. And, what is very, really fascinating is it's really about representations, because Xerox had the mouse. They all had the technology. They had everything. And so it was there. What they were missing is the right frame to make it something useful and powerful. And this is the only thing that really Steve Jobs brought to the table, a right way to model, represent what we could do with that mouse.
Mm. Francis, you talk a lot in the book, you and your co-writers, about the difference in success of certain types of businesses based on the way that they frame or, you know, frame in the wrong way. And you talk about Spotify. Spotify has become so ubiquitous and so popular, and it has to do with the way they framed, you say, around creating the experience. How so?
Well, the Apple created iTunes, if you remember, a long time ago. And so the idea here, they already disrupted the music industry by moving away from the notion of the album, that is where you would buy 10 songs and you had no choice. So really the innovation and the reframing they did at the time is to basically break those bundle into small songs. And if you remember, then came the iPod. And the beauty of that is that you could choose at the time the music you wanted to bring with you. So the focus of their frame was the flexibility to choose the type of music you wanted. Mm. What Spotify started to do is to forget about all that and to think of it as just as an experience, to have it not only at your fingerprint, but to have a place where you could experience very 5 minutes of music or 2 minutes of music you didn't know. That is to engage with the platform, to experience different form of music and choose what you wanted. So they really take this movement forward to a new level.
Mm. That's interesting. You know, I wanted to go back sort of to the beginning where part of the beauty of the book that you have written is that humans are able to sort of take back and reclaim our power as decision makers. We are barraged with information about how artificial intelligence is going to do all of our thinking for us. It's going to take away our jobs. And there's just nothing that humans can do about it. And yet, there's always this little niggling thing in the back that says that one of the things that artificial intelligence lacks is this human component. And you're making the argument that framing is one of those really important human components. Can you expand on that?
So we have experience. Humanity has experienced technological disruption that took away our jobs. This is not new. We've seen that many, many times. What is new now, what is really new, is that the machine is taking over some of our decisions. And that's where we thought we had the power. At the very least, we could control the machine. So that's the scary part. And when we started to write the book, what we noticed is that people, to defend the human, again, the machine, if you want, started to highlight the fact that humans have emotions, they have empathy, and all that is perfectly correct and right, but we felt it really misses the point. The point is that we as human beings can create our own representation of the world, our own frame, in a way that the machine can't. The machine is stuck to the data. The machine cannot go far, far away from the data. We human beings, you give me 4 data points, and I can extrapolate and imagine things that have never been directly experienced before. Machine cannot do that. But if we get stronger at it, we can not only survive the machine, but I think also use the machine to our advantage.
Francis, in the United States, the month of May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And I don't have to tell you that there are so many people in our world that are suffering from anxiety, depression, and other, you know, other insecurities. And I'm curious, can framing be used as a tool for relieving suffering by the mental health community and by the individuals that are suffering? And I kind of think that framing is sort of synonymous with perspective. And if you change your perspective, that seems to help in the mental health field as they counsel people. Can you think of examples of how framing can help people that are suffering?
I mean, what we know is that the most successful tools from the mental health community is based on the notion of reframing. Many people suffered because they are stuck in a way of representing the world. I mean, I can think of depression, for instance. We know that one of the best tools to fight depression is to teach people to reframe the way they think about their life, what makes them unhappy, and focus on different aspects. Now, you said that frames are synonym to perspectives. It's more than that, because there are key elements in frames, such as causality constraints and what we call counterfactuals that we explain in the book. But if you use a frame to help you when you're stuck in a situation, an unhappy marriage, for instance, or a conflict at work, to try to reanalyze the situation from a different frame point of view, you may also uncover new approach, new ways to deal with the situation, and hopefully get unstuck. But again, this is something that the healthcare medical community have been working on and developing for decades now.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I got about halfway through the book and I just came to this realization that this is a really important subject that we all need to take a look at for our as individuals, but also as organizations, companies, as counties, as towns, as countries, working on the different challenges we have. And also back to perspective, and I wasn't trying to simplify framing, but I remember the Dalai Lama once said that emotion is hard to change, but perspective is very easy to change. And so for an example, for him personally, when he was driven out of Tibet, he started thinking, you know, a lot of people are thrown out of their countries. A lot of people are driven out from where they live and they have to go somewhere else. He sort of joined a larger world and he felt that he was able, by reframing it that way, to be able to deal with it better. And I thought that was interesting.
Very nice example. Very, very nice example. Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, the lesson is all emotions are also the output of our frame. It's frame define how we represent the world, but also if we have a certain frame, it's going to elicit a different emotion. So it's a way to feel better.
Francis, before we let you go, we have just a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about organizations right now when they are pondering how to bring employees back in person, into the offices. I've noticed that, you know, 6 months ago, they started talking about it, you know, asking the employees, what do you prefer, and considering what the organization prefers. And it seems like such a big question, and I think it's because organizations have realized that employees are sort of reframing the way that they get work done and the way that they think about things. How do you represent that, and how can you help organizations as they make these decisions and employees?
I mean, you know, what is striking to me is that all the changes you're talking about, the fact that we got used to work from home, and in fact, that we found sometimes better ways to work from home, to be more efficient. What is fascinating to me that we had to wait for a pandemic to realize that. We could have done that before, you know, but how is it that we need these big disruptions to say, oops, oh, by the way, we can do that. What this tells me is that there are probably many other ways that are out there that may make our life easier at work. But because we are too stuck into our models, mental representations, we are not exploring. So I think as we go back to work, and by the way, I think there's no way back, because as you mentioned it, we change our mindset. And even if a company says, no, we need to go back to where we were before, it's impossible. Like, people know now that it can be more efficient. I think many companies are going to take advantage of it, quite frankly, as well, because they discovered they could save a lot of money with travels and all that. But the key lesson for me is not that. The key lesson is they are out there, different ways to work, to make our lives better. And the only thing that prevents us to embrace them is our inability to represent them well, to play with our frames.
Francis, I also want to mention the names of the people that you wrote with, Victor Meyer Schoenberger and Kenneth Couquier, if I pronounce their names correctly, I hope.
Yes.
But anyway, you know, I was thinking, and we're going to have to scoot. I could talk to you for hours, and so could Lynn.
Me too.
But I could see some classes where you're teaching framing or seminars or that sort of thing. Have you guys thought about that?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm teaching in a business school. I'm teaching to executives, and so yes, I'm teaching framing at for CEOs, in fact, and yes, we do it. I mean, I do it more than my co-authors probably, but I've been doing it for 10 years now.
Oh,
so yes, I've
you.
Been thinking of, about it a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take too much of your time, but the book is really also the outcome of this decade of experience teaching
right.
how to frame decision problems.
Well, we're just about out of time. We hope that you'll come back and join us again, because I'd like to talk to you some more, and I may even go out to Berlin and attend your class. But
please come by, pass by. It would be my pleasure.
Oh, fantastic. Francis de Vericourt has written a fascinating book with two other gentlemen, Kenneth Couquier and Victor Meyer Schoenberger, Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.